Today's lesson is an epilogue to our lesson on Naomi and Ruth that we finished last week. The take-home message of that lesson was that deep, authentic connections are essential for human well-being. Deep, authentic connections are essential for human well-being. And connections with the other, even more so. Connections with the other, even more so. But we saw, though these kinds of connections are essential for our well-being, we often don't make those kinds of connections because we are steeped in a culture of hyper-individualism. And thus steeped, oftentimes it never even occurs to us. It doesn't seem like the good thing to do or even to make sense to us that we should do X instead of Y when X is make connections kinds of things and Y is go my own way kinds of things. In fact, the X thing, the make connections thing, often seems bad. It seems the least sensible or it seems the least reasonable way to act or to react. And as a result, here we are as a society divided and distressed and suffering an epidemic of isolation and depression and anxiety and sleep troubles. And we saw over these last weeks, the story of Naomi and Ruth speaks to us from across the generations as it has to many generations before us. Deep, authentic connections are essential for human well-being, and connections with the other, even more so. So, when my son Daniel and I were, when he was still at home, we went to Mayumi's Aikido dojo that was held at our church in the old building. And by the way, she still runs that dojo here in this building. It's over in the fellowship hall in the second floor, if you're interested in that. But anyway, at the end of the beginner course, Mayumi hosted a party at her house, and she had gyoza. It was a gyoza party. Now, if you don't know what gyoza is, imagine dumplings meet God and then go in your mouth. Anyway, as I was enjoying gyoza, I commented to her how wonderful the food was, and she said something interesting. She said, well, it's just what we do in Japan. And I thought that was interesting, and so I asked her what she meant to elaborate, so she stopped her hosting duties for a moment, and she explained, and she said, well, in Japan, we don't really eat fancy food at home. We don't spend a lot of time and energy on food that we would eat by ourselves. We don't spend a lot of money on food that we would eat for ourselves or go to a lot of trouble. Instead, what we do is we save up until we have the money, we save up until we have the time, and then we do a big thing, and we invite a whole bunch of people over to share it with us. We invite people over for fancy food, and they invite us over for fancy food. We probably end up having fancy food about as often as Americans do, but what we do is when we're having it, we are always doing it in the context of being together with others. And so her passing comment while she was making gyoza stuck with me for all these years. How one society works with communal instincts and another society works with individualistic instincts and how that plays out in simple little ways like gyoza parties. Well, some psychology researchers studied this difference between how we experience life, East and West, and did a series of experiments to kind of explore how different it went. The first experiment was pretty simple. They told people to intentionally try to make themselves happier. And then they tracked how that worked for them. And the results were really interesting. Trying to make yourself happy does not make you happy if you live in the West. But, interestingly, trying to make yourself happy does make you happy if you live in Japan, or if you live in Russia, or if you live in Taiwan, if you live in the East. And so why is that, they asked, and they did another series of experiments that kind of unearthed this difference, deep difference, in how people think of themselves in the East and in the West, and how they position themselves in the world, in the East and in the West. One of the follow-up experiments they did was to show a picture to a group of friends. It's a simple picture. There's a man, and he's speaking to a crowd of people. And then they asked this group of friends who looked at the picture what they saw. Well, if those friends were Westerners, they can usually describe the person in the front with a great deal of detail. But they can't recall very many details about the crowd of people who are listening to the person in front speaking. But if they're from the East, it's just the other way around completely. They can usually describe the group, the crowd, with a great deal of detail, but the guy in front, almost as an afterthought, doesn't get much detail in the process. There's a basic difference in how we see the world and how we see ourselves positioned in the world. And that shapes the instincts that we bring to this project of trying to make ourselves happy. If we have group instincts, our efforts at making ourselves happy will be group efforts. If we have individual instincts, then our efforts at making ourselves happy will be individual efforts. And it turns out one of those set of efforts will make us happy, and the other set of efforts will not make us happy. The researchers did another very simple show-a-picture kind of experiment. This time they showed a group of kids a picture of a young girl who was smiling broadly. But this young girl was standing in the middle of a whole bunch of other young girls who were looking very sad. And the Western kids responded that they thought the little girl was happy. Of course, she was smiling. But the Eastern kids, they thought the little girl was sad. Because Western kids can easily isolate individuals from the group, but Eastern kids take it for granted that if she's surrounded by sadness, she will be sad. So, these are the instincts that run in our brains. And we just inherited them. We didn't decide on this worldview. We just woke up inside this worldview. But it does affect what's going to happen when we make the decision that we need to be happier. If we set out to make ourselves happy, but we live in the United States or we live in Britain, we are going to pursue happiness for ourselves. Well, of course we do, because in our minds, that's the way the world works. But if we decide that we need to be happier and we live in Russia or we live in Japan or if we live in Taiwan, we go about it quite differently. We try to make things better for the group. And sure enough, what the researchers found is that when a Russian or a Japanese or a Chinese person goes to work to make themselves happier, they get happier. But when British people or American people set out to do the same project, nope, not happier. Our Western recipe for happiness doesn't actually work. A communal approach to happiness actually works. In the West, in our minds, we have reduced our sense of self to me, or at most to my family, but mostly just me. And as we've seen over these last several weeks, looking at the story of Ruth, that comes with a lot of negative consequences. So when we are depressed, as we've seen this epidemic of depression, as we've looked at this epidemic of isolation and anxiety, when we are depressed and we look for a solution to our pain, when we are anxious, when we are hurting, and we look for a solution to our hurt, we look for a solution for me, an individual solution that I can enact alone. The thing those people in Kati did, that neighborhood in Berlin that I talked about a few weeks ago, the story about the Turkish laborers, the very traditional religious Turkish laborers, and the punk rock runaways, and the gay people who had been kind of ostracized from the other communities, when they were forced by circumstance to make meaningful connections and how it healed their souls, that approach doesn't usually occur to us in the West, because we don't tend to think of ourselves linked together with other people in the most basic defining nature of our being. Instead, our instincts take us, when we've got these kinds of problems that the neighborhood of Kati had, we look for a pill I can take by myself, a solution for my pain and my mood, and a solution that works in my brain that helps me cope. And drugs are powerful enough that they can actually work for a while, but as we saw in the first week, over a sustained period of time, their efficacy is considerably reduced. The instinct that we bring to bear as hyper-individualized Westerners are instincts that betray us. They are not rooted in a true truth. Our hyper-individualistic instincts, they shut us off from strategies that actually work to make human beings happy. They put us inside brains and bodies and souls that work against the way that brains and bodies and souls are wired. So in a sense, we are imprisoned in our Western instincts, imprisoned inside our individualistic egos. Listen to this text, a paraphrase of the Christian scripture Philippians. Don't obsess over your own life, your own well-being, your own advantage. That's not really a recipe for happiness. Be with others. Help others. Care for others as they care for you. Love others as they love you. This is a recipe for deep friendships. The other way, we get so focused on our own little lives, we end up losing what really matters. It's counterintuitive, but if all you think about is yourself, you end up a miserable person. But shift your focus away from yourself, help others get ahead, and you end up happy. That text comes from an old guy helping a young guy figure out how life works. Here's how life goes, youngster. Don't get too focused on your own plans. There won't be enough time or energy left over to engage with others and their plans. Don't get too focused on your pain, your own worry. You won't even see the pain or the worry of other people. And therefore, you won't stand with them and you won't support them. And don't get too focused on whether other people are standing with you in your pain or in your troubles. No, turn the tables around. Because it turns out that if you stand with others, you'll find that life tends to give back to you. Give and it will be given unto you. That's the way Jesus said it. Now, some parenthetical remarks. We study the Enneagram as a community, so forgive me for a little bit of personality type jargon for a second. But if your personality is in the heart triad, what I just said might be really toxic for you. What I just said is your kryptonite. Because your go-to instinct is to manage the world by caring about everybody else so everybody else will care for you. And when Paul comes along and says, do more of that, you're already wearing yourself down to a nub by doing that. And, oh, God, how am I going to do more? I've already just exhausted myself. And so, yeah, kryptonite. However, that doesn't change the efficacy of the ancient wisdom. It just means you have to be, you're going to have to do a really good job of discerning out where your blind spots factor in. And so heed that. End of parenthetical remarks. Anyway, this older man is saying to this younger man, it's crazy, right? But this is kind of how life works. Don't make the most common mistake that people make, and that is to get so focused on your own problems that you end up with an unhappy life. Go a different way. Be unselfish enough to experience meaningful connections with other people. It's easy to miss the needs that other people have, even those people that we love. It's easy not to pay attention. It's easy not to give much interest to those other needs. It's especially easy to fall into this age-old trap when we are the great-great-grandchildren of this hyper-Western individualism that has, in our generation, really gone to seed. We are wired for deep, authentic connections. They are essential to human well-being, and we are especially wired for connections with the other. So that means for us, just growing up in these Western brains as we do, the most critical key to our long-term health and well-being is not what we tend to think it is. We tend to think it's self-worth. If I can establish self-worth in the West, then I'm going to thrive. Or we think that it's going to be focused on my individualized power, focused on making sure that I can make happen what needs to happen, or my own success, or my own likableness, or... But it turns out, for us, the most critical piece, because of this glaring lack that our mindset sets before us, is to be connected, to be a part of a larger group. For us, it's more important that we learn how to lower our ego walls and live in other people's stories as other people are living in our stories. For us, it turns out to be more important that we carry other people's hurts as they carry our hurts. For us, it turns out to be more important that we are aware of and carry other people's needs as they are aware of and carry our needs. So for us in the West, it turns out, what's more critical for our health and well-being is to be less private and less personal and less focused on keeping our own heads above water and less focused on doing what makes me, myself, feel better, buying something for myself or treating myself to something or reading a book that I like or watching something that I like. That's a pretty common go-to instinct for us in the West, individualized as we are, but it is also a set of instincts that tend to isolate us, and that doesn't work for very long. When we feel bad, there's a good chance that the way that we will feel better is to try and do something for someone else and to do it without consideration of what we get in return. We might call it developing the art of self-forgetfulness. Visit someone and shift our focus away from how we are doing to how they are doing, from how we are feeling to how they are feeling, and ask ourselves, is there something that we could do to make other people feel better? Even when we are in pain, there is a good chance that we can also find someone else who is in pain. So I showed you this book a couple weeks ago when I was telling you that story of Kati. But also in this book, and by the way, it's worth reading, Lost Connections, the author's name is Hari. Also in that book, the author recounts conversations that he's had with researchers who are looking into the impact that social media is having on our lives. During the What Are You Thinking time, it was either last week or the week before, I mentioned how social media is here to stay. There are a lot of good things that happen. To say that to get really upset with the media, with social media, and say it's going away, is kind of like getting really upset at air conditioning and saying it's going away. So we are going to have to figure out how not to ruin the planet with air conditioning. But the fact that we're just going to give up on air conditioning and live in Raleigh in August, yeah, the odds are that's not going to happen. We got to figure out what to do with it that will make it effective. So it's not going away, and because it does a lot of good things. But it's also important to know the good things that it does not do. What it does not do is make the kind of meaningful connections that we are talking about. It can be auxiliary support to those things, but it cannot make those things. Now, that's a problem because we kind of think it will. We are acting as though it will. We are mobilizing our energy and our time and our priorities as though it is going to deliver something that it cannot deliver. So we suck up all of our time and all of our energy that could have been spent doing the things that we need to do in order to make meaningful connections, and it doesn't do that. But here's the thing the book helped me understand. It put it in context. I thought it had to do with, you know, we're living in the microwave generation, we quack like... the algorithms are designing us for quick dopamine cycle return. I thought it was a lot to do with that, and I think it does. But social media showed up about 20 to 25 years ago when our society was already facing an epidemic of isolation and aloneness. It felt like it scratched a deep itch. It felt like it fed a deep hunger. It doesn't, but it felt like it did. And so we were just drawn to it. On average, people check their phone, Americans check their phone, about every 7.5 minutes during their waking hours. The average teenager checks their texts about, sends a text about 100 times every day. I often meet people in coffee shops, and so someone will go get a refill on their coffee. It probably takes 40 seconds. In the 40 seconds from the time it takes them to go, get their coffee, and come back, I have learned to fight this resistance to, let me see what's going on my phone in the 40 seconds while they're gone getting a coffee. I'm working really hard not to do that, but the instinct is there. You know, you watch people pull up to a stoplight. We are now going to have perhaps 90 seconds. And in that 90 seconds, let's see if we can get an email return. Let's see what we can do. It is kind of a compulsive thing. And we've seen it's a problem. So we've got apps that come out. I think the newest version of the iPhone came out. It comes with an app that says, hey, make sure you're monitoring your time. If you haven't got quality time on your phone, you can kind of see where you're spending your time, at least be aware of what you're doing. We have those apps because we think that we're recognizing we kind of have an addiction, but we think it's an addiction to the screen. And we think it's an addiction that is caused by the technology and the algorithms. And sure enough, that's true. You know, everybody's competing for mind space, and they want to just wiggle into every little bit of space they have. So there's an algorithm that'll say, here, watch this thing, do this thing, let us have access to your brains. And that's part of it. What the book helped me see is that that is the thing. And sure enough, there is a thing under the thing. So yes, we can get pretty compulsive about our phones, but the more important question is, what's driving that compulsion? The dopamine reward system that the algorithms do, that's a thing. But below that, there is this low-grade isolation, this low-grade anxiety, this low-grade depression that is an epidemic in our society. It is so much a part of our Western society, and what the screen can do is distract us from this thing. One of the things that Denise did when our kids were young was determine that it was going to be good for them to learn how to be bored. So she would set them in the room, and there wouldn't be any kind of entertainment stuff, and they would need to create something in that space to work with boredom. And we don't do that very well as a society. And that's a thing, and that's good for us, and we should do that. The problem, though, is that we avoid boredom like the plague because boredom comes with this sense of unconnectedness. When we are not busy, 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 when we are not going, 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 when we are not filling, filling, filling our time, and we quiet down, what's there is isolation. When we quit going and looking and looking and clicking and we quiet down, what's there is this sense of not being connected, of not belonging. That's the epidemic that's going on in our society. This is an attempt to medicate that. So there is a thing where we've got phone addiction now, and so we have phone addiction treatment centers. And I was reading about one person who was running one of these phone addiction or internet addiction treatment centers. And they say that 90% of the time that someone shows up to deal with their phone addiction, they had a pre-existing condition, and that pre-existing condition was isolation. The pre-existing condition was alienation. The pre-existing condition was loneliness. That was already a problem before the phone addiction set in. The phone is a way to medicate the consequences of isolation. So, isolation is a problem social media cannot solve. It can only distract us from it. Virtual connections without real-world connections going along alongside, they only feel like we know and are known. They only feel like we belong, but we don't. In multiplayer games, we only feel like we are part of a group that is on a mission with status in the group. But it's an illusion. We're not part of a group on a mission. Alienation and isolation and depression, they came first. Compulsive internet use, that's the new problem. But it was really an attempt to solve the old problem. The internet is a go-to addiction because it showed up when we had already lost deep connections to one another. We had already lost status, and so we needed to go have status. We had already lost our tribes, and so we needed to go find a tribe. But the internet doesn't touch our actual need for communal connection. What we really need happens face-to-face. What we really need happens when we serve one another. What we really need happens when we can see and touch and feel and smell and hear one another. Don't obsess over your own life, your own well-being, your own advantage. It's not really a recipe for happiness. Be with others, help others, care for others as they care for you. Love others as they love you. This is a recipe for deep friendships. The other way, we get so focused on our own little lives, we end up losing what really matters. It's counterintuitive, but if all you think about is yourself, you end up a miserable person. But shift your focus away from yourself, help others get ahead, and you end up happy. So, indwelling Spirit of God, may we be alert to the interior nudges that call us toward meaningful connections. And may we be resilient in the challenges that we face when we try to make meaningful connections. And may we have open hearts to other people and invite them into the same kind of meaningful connections. Be that so in our lives as we follow Jesus. Amen.